Bell, Caballero, Dolly, Hurtado, Jones, Leyva, McGuire, Monning, Morlock, Pan, Roth, Skinner, Stern, Stone, Umberg, Wycoski. We have a quorum.
Thank you very much. The secretary notices the presence of a quorum. I'd like to welcome everyone to, I think I've said the last couple of times, to the final budget hearing of the year. But I think this time it really will be final. Thank you. Today we're going to hear one bill, the Housing and Homelessness Trailer Bill, again, which is the final trailer bill associated with the current budget package. After today's hearing, AB 101 will be eligible to be taken up on the floor, colleagues, this afternoon. Prior to starting, it's no time like, you know, the last hearing of the year to have two new members join us. So we want to welcome to Senate Budget Committee Senators Dolly and Caballero. Welcome to the Senate Budget Committee. With that, Mr. Vice Chairman, any remarks from you? Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, Finance. We're prepared to hear from you on AB 101.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The key items in this bill are regarding housing and homelessness. On housing, this bill allocates $1.75 billion in total spending to address the housing crisis. And in homelessness, the overall budget package that was agreed to between the administration and the legislature invests $1 billion in homelessness services and prevention, of which $650 million is in this bill. And I'll briefly go through both of those items. On the housing package, this bill includes $250 million in planning and production grants for local jurisdictions. This is split between $125 million for local jurisdictions and $125 million for regional efforts. And also includes $500 million for the infill infrastructure grant program, and that includes a rural set aside of $90 million, particularly for counties with less than a quarter million people. There's also $500 million to Cal HFA for a mixed income loan program, and finally $500 million to expand the use of the low income housing tax credit program. In addition to this programmed $1.75 billion in spending for housing supports, the bill also includes a plan for bonus points for jurisdictions with pro-housing policies and when they're applying for discretionary grants, and these include programs like Transformative Climate Communities, the Affordable Housing and Sustainable Communities Program, and the aforementioned Infill Infrastructure Grant Program. It also includes some changes for the Local Housing Trust Fund, making matching grants available to Native American tribes, as well as support for more building of auxiliary dwelling units. These are secondary, often known as granny flats, to increase the supply of housing. When it comes to homelessness, the overall budgeted amount is $650 million, and we know there's been a lot of negotiation between members of the administration and legislature and legislative staff, and the allocation that is in this bill is $275 million for what's known as the Big 13. These are cities with above 300,000 people in population. In addition to that, there's $175 million for counties, $190 million for continuums of care. These are known as COCs. They're designated by the Department of Housing and Urban Development at the federal level for more regional efforts, and finally $10 million to be programmed at a future date. In addition to those funds, this bill also expands the eligible use of funds and more flexibility in how jurisdictions attack the homelessness crisis. They make it easier to build low-barrier navigation centers, including expanding the use of by-right building, and as well extending the deadline for the audit of the community-based transitional housing program. And this was previously a review, and now will be an audit. And then the final part of this package that I want to mention is with regard to remedies for jurisdictions that don't meet their housing element as required by law. Of course, the administration wants to work with jurisdictions and hopes that every jurisdiction that is not in compliance can come into compliance. For those jurisdictions that don't, that they don't plan to meet those planning and zoning targets, there will be, under this bill, a notice and two conversations, either in person or over the phone, with that jurisdiction to try to bring them into compliance. Only after those conversations and that due process will a referral be made to the Attorney General's office for a lawsuit. against that jurisdiction. If that lawsuit takes place and if it is successful and the judge rules that the jurisdiction is not in compliance with existing state housing element law, at that point the judge would have to issue a separate order saying that the jurisdiction must come into compliance, and the jurisdiction would have a full year to do so. Only after that full year elapsed and the jurisdiction is still not in compliance with existing law at that date would fines be imposed on that jurisdiction. These would be between $10,000 and $100,000. And then if the jurisdiction continues not to come into compliance after that, there are some additional remedies. The fines could be increased. And finally, as a last resort, within the discretion of the court, an agent of the court may be appointed to help bring that jurisdiction into compliance. So I know this has been the product of a lot of productive negotiation and conversation with members of the legislature and legislative staff. So we appreciate the chance to work with you and happy to take questions on any element of this package.
Thank you very much. Mr. Dolly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as somebody who sat on a Board of Supervisors for 16 years and did general plan amendments, and so I'm concerned about the compliance part for cities and counties that aren't in compliance. And you know that if you have a general plan that is in conformance and you don't meet your housing element, it's quite frankly 99% of the time it's due to the fact that developers aren't taking advantage of the general plan options because they can't afford to get a return on their investment. And that, so I've ran the trap line on quite a few of the communities I represent, and the cost is so high that there's too much risk, and that's why we don't see a lot of houses built, quite frankly, in all of California. So now we're gonna go in and compound that even more. So local jurisdictions don't have the ability to raise taxes to pay even fines to if they're gonna come in, and I know you're trying to encourage them along through what the process that you're talking about. I understand that, but at the end of the day, if you can't afford to build those homes now, until we drive the cost of those homes down somehow, you're not gonna get more homes. We're gonna be in the same, that's why they're not building homes now, is because developers, there's too big of a risk and they don't get a return on their investment. So it's like continuing to go after cities and counties don't build houses. We incentivize, yes, that's what we're doing here. We're actually going to put money into incentivize housing, which is will be helpful in driving that cost down, but there's that money's coming from taxpayers. So I'm a little nervous about having a hammer on cities and counties because they're not really the ones that build homes. It's developers that build homes.
I think I'll make a couple brief points, and then my colleague Danielle may want to weigh in as well. The first thing is for this specific law, the housing element, it's not really focused on the production, although that is the goal, to get these houses built in the end. Of course, that's what we want, and this is part of that. But when I say it's not focused on that, the jurisdictions don't actually have to produce the houses in order to comply with the law. This is even well before that. It's simply putting together a plan and making planning and zoning decisions that are in compliance with housing element law. So it's much more before developers say, hey, it's expensive to build here. And part of the law, and you mentioned its incentives as well, with the infrastructure grant program, often developers don't want to build because the infrastructure to support that building isn't really there. So we understand that there is support there. But this is before then existing law, just saying with state housing element law, you should put together a plan and make zoning decisions that comply with that, whether developers or others build or not. And then I think the second part is, you mentioned some of these jurisdictions, everyone is in a different situation. So as part of the remedies, including those that are a last resort, there is a part of the bill that allows for mitigating circumstances if a jurisdiction didn't have the resources. Obviously, you know, we've talked a lot in this committee about emergency situations. You know, in Paradise, this law is not going to be enforced against the community like that when they're coming out of a disaster like that. So there is some discretion for the judge to make those types of determinations.
So is there any funds available in here to actually help them with their general plan amendments?
So generally, we view the $250 million that's going to local jurisdictions as providing the technical assistance to come up with these plans.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Senator Morlock.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there any integration with No Place Like Home? Because we're trying to build housing with Prop 2 funds, so I'm wondering if we can do some blending so we get a bonus to some of these communities.
Good afternoon. Danielle Brenda with the Department of Finance. No Place Like Home funds should be deployed this they have been deployed, my apologies, this late last spring, and the uses are similar to some of these others, and they can be used in combination with other funds to basically build housing and transitional housing.
And just from another question, different subject, but just from an economic standpoint, if we know this infusion of funding is becoming available, would that keep the price of raw land, these infill properties, would that keep it stable? Would it increase it? Would it decrease it? Would it, do you have a, like a, an economic model on what might happen?
So you're talking specifically about the existing price of land without development on it?
Right. If I had some infill property, I'm thinking if there was a state program coming with some funding, I might want to hold out for a higher price.
So I think the way we have been thinking about this is by right now, in a lot of these on this land, it's simply not zoned for housing. So, you know, whereas that one specific property, if you zone it for additional uses, it could potentially increase the value of that land. But if the overall supply of housing in California is increased, that should, in our view, make housing more affordable.
And then my last question, we keep hearing about Marin. Is Marin exempted?
So I don't believe there's anything in this bill before you regarding Marin. I don't believe it's in this bill.
They're always special.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Senator Stern.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Viswanathan. I want to just ask you to flesh out this substantial compliance framework and help us really understand what substantial compliance means versus just a sort of strict framework. Can you help elaborate?
Yes. So the way the administration and working with members of the legislature thinking about this is we wanted to make sure that we are bringing jurisdictions into compliance with the law, but we also wanted jurisdictions to understand that we were not going to nickel and dime them or hit them for every last violation. We want them to comply, and the penalties are only if they not only don't comply, but after a period of at least 1 to 1.5 years, after the judge issues their final order, they're still not in compliance. So the reason we use the term substantial compliance is we wanted jurisdictions to know that if you are basically doing the right thing, you know, maybe there's a certain part of your plan that doesn't exactly align with what HCV had imagined at the outset, but the court sees it as they're trying to follow the law, they're making a good faith effort that they hadn't made before, and then that brings you into substantial compliance with the law. So it goes back to that purpose of we want jurisdictions to do the right thing. Even at the end of this remedy, a court imposed remedy, we still want to make sure that we are working with them and not simply filing lawsuits against them.
So what factors play into that determination then of sort of a good faith effort? Efforts towards a planning update? I mean, sort of what factors are indicia? I'm just wondering what the courts would look to in terms of not being total strict constructionists on exactly what it means.
So I think there are two things to note. One is that the court would look at and say, is your pattern of behavior significantly different from before? You know, because when you think about what even brings the lawsuit into place, it's only after these two meetings, it's after a notice, then the attorney general files the lawsuit, and then there's a whole court hearing before the court imposes its judgment. And so presumably things are only getting to that point because there is a pretty wide gulf between the law as interpreted by the Department of Housing and Community Development and how the jurisdiction is acting. So if there is a big switch in the jurisdiction's behavior within that 1 year after the judgment is entered, then you know certainly a court would look at that as a big factor in compliance. And whether it's substantial is up to the discretion of the court, but they would be weighing those factors. And then I think the second is that the court, in assessing any penalties, and I know we discussed this briefly, would look at any mitigating circumstances. And so those could be in terms of the resources the jurisdiction has, any external events, any changes that are happening there. So I think all of these factors weigh into what that substantial compliance standard is.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Nielsen.
As we've addressed homeless over the years, and there have been many bills, this is just another in a continuum. Is there anything in this particular legislation that would help direct the homeless individual towards resources, not just housing, where they can live and reside, sleep? find shelter from the storms. But to put themselves in an employable category so they can be self-sufficient, to direct them towards rehabilitative opportunities, which many of them need, alcohol, substance abuse, for example. I don't see much focus on the long-term solution. It's not just trying to keep building and building and building to keep up with the population of increasing numbers of homeless, but it also has to delve into dealing with the issues that cause those individuals to be homeless and hopefully get many not to have to be in that class or choose to be in that class.
So I would make 2 points. You're absolutely right that it's not simply about expanding housing options, although that is a big part of it. And so I think there are two things that this bill and the broader budget do. First, specifically in this bill, when the governor's budget was released in January, it proposed not simply shelters, but also navigation centers and a focus on permanent supportive housing all across that spectrum. And what we've done since then, working with and receiving feedback from members of the legislature, is expanding the number of options for which that money can be used. So we're not controlling it at the state level. Local jurisdictions will have a lot of flexibility, but they know on the ground closest to them where the needs are and how to make sure not only that we're helping people get shelter, but that we're moving as many people as we can into permanent supportive housing and then eventually, in some cases, without needing further state support. So there is that flexibility within the $650 million in this bill. And then the second thing I'll say, and not all of these elements are within the specific bill before you, but the administration's budget also includes whole person care pilots and a number of, you know, rapid rehousing efforts at UC and CSU and community colleges, because if people can get housing there, they get their degree, it's less likely that they will be in housing emergencies. So I think you see a number of efforts within the budget, including also reentry for people who are transitioning out of a correctional facility, that we think are really important to attack this issue from all angles.
But will there be any level of assessment? For example, the navigation centers have an attraction to me. But at that navigation center, which is a central place, would there be any assessment capability at that center? Would local government have the opportunity, the resources, the means, the empowerment to assess the needs of that individual, not just in terms of where they would reside, but how they would be able to provide for themselves and find resources for the challenges that they face? Will there be those opportunities in the navigation centers?
I believe so, because we are not prescribing the funding to that level of detail in statute in this bill. So I believe that local jurisdictions will have a lot of flexibility in making those types of determinations.
Well, it's a little late in the game, but I would suggest verbiage in the bill admonishing or encouraging local government to focus on that would be helpful.
Ms. Caballero, followed by Ms. Skinner.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank you for the structure for that the housing element compliance and court remedies. Initially, there was some discussion about a much more onerous penalty at the end, which would have allowed the state to come in and take over. And I think that created some anxiety for many of us who come from local government. Even if it was never utilized, the fact that it's there becomes, I think, a challenge, since local government and the state all represent the same people. So I appreciate the structure. I also appreciate the escalating nature of the compliance penalties, because we're talking about the first step in planning for housing. We're not talking about whether you're producing it or not. This is really the first step, which is the planning step. And so I really do appreciate that and wanted to make sure that I communicated that there are many of us that are much happier with the way that it's been structured at this point.
I should clarify, in the interest of full transparency, there is, as a last resort at the end of this bill, the court, within its discretion, could appoint an agent of the court to help bring the jurisdiction into compliance, but as you noted, it is only after a series of steps where every effort is made to address the issue with other remedies.
Well, and it's also a court initiated process.
Correct. Yes.
And appointed by the court.
Correct.
And so that I think further removes the state from that whole framework.
Yes. Ms. Skinner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is a good bill, and there's most elements I'm very, very happy with. There's one concern that I have, and in the homelessness section, where we provide the funding to the cities and then to the counties and to the continuum of care, the language in the sections starting with page 44, lines 24 on, it addresses being able to deal with immediate homeless challenges. But then the language in those lines, 25, 26, 27, is explicit of, it's very narrow, that it needs to move homeless individuals and families into permanent housing and supporting the efforts of those individuals and families, meaning the homeless families. So then you go on to page 46, and in line 14, 15, 16, it references that the funds can be used for prevention, so that would indicate someone who is not yet homeless. But then it goes down to lines 27, 28, 29, 30, which seem to reference federal definitions, which are very narrowly construed to be only people who are already homeless or within 14 days of becoming homeless. So then if we go to page 47, it indicates that we can use the funds to address and prevent homelessness, including rental assistance. My concern is that by the narrow definition of that you have to be within 14 days of being homeless, that it would restrict, that they seem to be contradictory, and it would only allow an entity who is applying for these funds who wants to provide support to prevent a family from becoming homeless to only provide them that support if they're within 14 days of becoming homeless. Most folks who are faced with either the potential for eviction or even eviction know it before 14 days. And a window of 14 days is a very short window to really assist and prevent them from losing their home. So I asked my staff to take the bill to Ledge Council to see if my interpretation, because I didn't want to, and Ledge Council says, yes, it seems to be contradictory, or they might not use that language, but rather that that clarifying language might be helpful. And I realize that we want to pass today. I'm hoping that we can do some cleanup language, because when I read the bill, it seems very clear in its intent that we want to give people flexibility to be able to use the funding if they so choose to help prevent people from becoming homeless. And we may need, what I asked Ledge Council is, what is the simplest amendment that could make sure that these are not at odds? And I want to raise this because, not only because it seems like we have this clear intent and I don't want it to be contradictory, but additionally, if we look at the data for the rise in homelessness in the last 5 years, and we've seen these jumps, 17% over a period of a year, just between 17 and 18 in many of our jurisdictions, those people, the data shows, are not mentally ill, are not addicted. Many have families. All were housed, never unhoused prior. All have jobs. So these are all people that fall into that category of facing that unexpected expense, which then led them to get behind on rent potentially, and now I'm speculating, but they faced an unexpected expense, or they found themselves where they were living. Maybe the person whose name was on the lease left or had to move and their name wasn't on the lease, and so then they didn't have protections or any number of other things that if we can intervene before they're on the street, it is far, far less resources to keep them housed. And we know that, for example, the mayors, the 14 mayors or the 13 mayors, all wrote us a letter saying that they wanted to make sure that they would have the flexibility to use this for emergency rental assistance. So I'm being very clear about it now because I realize everyone wants us to vote for it and pass it right now, but I want that clarified, and I would look forward to the language. Maybe it's right after break.
And let me get clear about what languages you're looking for. So time period beyond 14 days, I'm hearing two things from you.
Right.
Clarification about who it applies to, the existing homeless or those who potentially will be, A. And so you want more flexibility so the dollars could apply to both, correct?
Yes.
And then the 14 days.
Right, it would have to be more than 14 days. So, and when I say that, clearly, we don't want it available to anyone. So obviously,
that has to be
some narrowed, yes. Okay. But we just don't want to be, because our ability to intervene for somebody who's about to be on the street in 14 days is a
narrow window.
Yeah.
Got it.
Thank you.
And so we'll have offline conversations about that. But I wanted to make sure that you were clear about what the specific ask is. Thank you. Moving on to Senator McGuire, followed by Senator Bell. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're more than welcome.
Madam Chair, I was just going to address the Vice Chair's comment, and that's in regards to the homeless funds. And please correct me if I'm wrong. I believe the Homeless Housing Assistance and Prevention Program is the former HEAP funds. It's the one time, the $650 million that would be programmed, and they're extremely flexible is all I was going to say. So it's ultimately up to the jurisdiction about how they want to be able to spend. There are benchmarks in there about how it should be spent, but it's very broad and allows up to the jurisdiction what works best for the most part. So I know that there was some concern, and there's a lot of flexibility in that working within the framework that is provided. Thank you.
Appreciate that clarification. Senator Bell?
Yes. Thank you. Thank you for this lengthy document. I wanted to ask you, in terms of the budget, how many housing units will the bill provide? Do you have a number?
I don't believe we have an estimate for this bill, but I will check with our finance team.
Okay.
To see if we have any.
So I wanted to find out if you have a base goal of, you know, like measuring progress. Here's how many units we're planning to accomplish. What is the base goal? Okay, then the area that I'm specifically concerned about, I'll just say this. In looking at the bill very carefully this morning, the 30 to 50% low and extremely low income category, that's kind of the soft spot on your bill, okay? I feel like the homeless program, we did a pretty good job. We passed the Proposition 2 last year. We put substantial funds in this bill for the homeless programs. We're keeping it flexible, which we're giving the cities, the counties, continuum of care programs funds. We're doing pretty good. Then the tax credit program, the 80 to 120% income category, we're really beefing it up with this bill. Did a good job on that. But the area that's a problem for me is the area that Senator Skinner was talking about, and that's the at-risk to homeless category. And I think we're not there yet on this bill, okay? I don't see much emphasis in this bill on that category. That's the 30 to 50% that has been identified by the Department of Housing as having a need for as much as 1.5 million units shortage. And these are the people that are falling into homeless. In fact, Sacramento right here, last year, just year to year was 19% increase. And we're getting similar numbers in Los Angeles, San Jose, San Francisco. All the communities are having these increases in the homeless, and it's the people in this category that are falling into homeless. And the question is, do you agree that we should follow up with this bill in studying what we could do with that category? We need to follow up and deal with that particular area, or else we're going to have way more homeless people year after year after year, and we're going to keep falling behind every year in terms of total number of homeless people that we have in California. And you know, I think we're dealing with the homeless that we have now good, but I think we're not recognizing that we're having a trend here that's really a bad trend. It's dangerously bad. And part of it's caused by things like the cancellation of the deed restrictions that federally subsidized housing units have in terms of the deed restrictions that were placed on these units like 30, 40, 50 years ago that are now expiring. And so now these units are being priced at a market rate. The rents are risen. The increase, the failure of any kind of rent control or rent issues has really caused a large number of rents to go up, which pushes people out of their units, quite frankly. That's the consequence. We know this is happening, and we're seeing the numbers. The homeless counts are just going up, you know, just in a crisis mode manner. But in the budget here, this trailer bill doesn't recognize that particular category. Honestly, it doesn't. I mean, if you look at it from a true standpoint, it really doesn't. So can you comment about what we have to do next? You know, if we're going to adopt this is kind of a half the game, but I think we have to address this crisis category that we have. Can you address that? What the intention of the governor? This is a one-time budget mainly. Can you address what comes next, or what we're going to be looking at in the future to address this critical crisis that we have?
Yes, so I'll make 2 points, so thank you for that. I think the first is that you are right that a number of these programs follow a broader, more mixed income, you know, up to 120% of area median income percentage. And when it comes specifically, though, to the focus that you mentioned, we do believe that part of our expansion of the low-income housing tax credit makes a difference there. And I will say about that part of the package, whereas most of the other items with regard to spending in this bill are one-time, that is an ongoing allocation, that $500 million, which is split, but part of that really is focused on expanding that 4% tax credit and making sure it gets to those families. But on the broader point, you are correct that the governor doesn't believe that this one bill by itself will solve the issue, and he knows that there's so much more to do. So he and the administration are definitely looking later in this session over the upcoming year to continue to see what more we can do in this area.
Is there recognition that this category that we're talking about is the soft spot in this housing trailer bill? It's a soft spot. You're right about the tax credits. I think it was $200 million out of the $500 million, correct? Well, that's nice, but it's not going to plug the dike of the rise in homelessness. That's nice, but it's not going to solve the problem.
And there's certainly more to do. There's no question about that.
I think there's a package of bills going through the process also, Senator Bell, that I hope that the legislature will hopefully take action and get to the governor's desk.
Yeah, I wanted to point out that the rent control bills that died are going to have a very bad effect over the next year, yeah, in my opinion.
And so you're preaching to the choir here, sir. Senator Jones.
Thank you, Chairwoman. This has been an interesting, I've learned two things today as a new senator. I learned earlier that the CSU has to come to the legislature to get permission to expand their doctorate programs. I didn't know that as a CSU grad. And the second thing I've learned today, and Senator Morlock alluded to it, is the Marin County issue. And I just wanted to kind of, for the other new senators that maybe aren't familiar with it, I was intrigued by this, and I've got an article from last year by Dan Walters And the headline is Marin County gets another smug reprieve from housing quotas. And when I read this earlier today, there was a particular quote that's jumped out at me. It's on the second page. It's, however, without waiting for a scheduled report on the county's progress on meeting its housing quotas, the Assemblymember from Marin persuaded legislative leaders last month to insert, and remember this is last year, leaders last month to insert into a budget trailer bill, Senate Bill 106, a brief passage that extends Marin County's exemption from quotas for an additional 5 years until 2028. By being attached to a trailer bill that contained many other provisions rather than offered as a standalone policy matter, the Marin exemption stood a much better chance and is one of many examples of how trailer bills are blatantly misused. And I, so end quote on that, it's a couple of paragraphs long, the entire article. I was wondering if the new, and Governor Brown signed that bill, and I'm wondering if the new governor has opined on the Marin County issue, and you know, as you've already answered Senator Morlock, this particular bill doesn't address it, but are we gonna see some parity between the 57 other counties and Marin County when it comes to these housing quotas and the requirements that the, and you know, I think as rightly has been shared by a lot of people on this dais, all of our counties want to, are trying to be helpful. So I'm just wondering if the new governor has opined on this, or if the Department of Finance might have an opinion.
So I can't speak to that directly. As you mentioned, it was in a previous administration. Certainly, as part of the regional housing needs assessment process, we're convening stakeholders over the next couple of years to make sure that that process is working as well as possible. But on that specific issue, don't really have anything to report beyond what's in the bill before you today.
I think some of the housing advocates from last year, and I know there's even a great quote in this article from Senator Nielsen, I think he did a good job of answering to the concern, but I would hope that the governors would listen to those housing advocates and take their concerns under consideration. Thank you.
Thank you. Before we double back to Senator McGuire, anyone else who hasn't posed a question yet have one? Seeing none, Senator McGuire, followed by Morlock. Senator McGuire.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and I'll be very brief. Look, I get that Marin County is a fine punching bag for many in this legislature, but I'd like to be able to clarify what exactly was in the budget here 3 years ago. Number one, there is no exemption. It was based off of density. So Marin County was labeled as an urban county. It has 250,000 folks, 250,000 total population. So what the budget did, it was based off of density, how many homes per acre the county will build and the cities within that county would build. So rather than labeling Marin County as urban, it was recategorized to suburban. Give you an example of a suburban county, Sonoma with 500,000, San Mateo with 650,000. Again, I'd like to repeat, Marin County has 250,000 people. They were characterized as formally in the law as urban. So what the bill did, it transitioned them from an urban county to a suburban county. There was no exemption.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for the clarification. Appreciate that. Senator Morlock.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that it's difficult to discuss ongoing litigation, but we've already made an example of the city of Huntington Beach, and I'm just kind of curious, now that you have a process, formal process that you're proposing, do you intend to continue with this case, or do you plan on rebooting and treating them the same as the proposed policy?
So I cannot discuss ongoing litigation, as you presumed. I will say, you know, with even with that lawsuit, when that lawsuit was filed, the governor made it clear that I believe it was more than 40 jurisdictions that weren't currently in compliance. His goal, the administration's goal, is not to file a bunch of lawsuits. It's to bring these jurisdictions into compliance. And under the process outlined in this bill, if the court determines that, to Senator Stern's point, that the jurisdiction is in substantial compliance, then none of these remedies will apply after that fact. This process, this bill before you makes some changes to the remedies, but the underlying law that we hope and expect jurisdictions to comply with is still the same.
So I believe that the arena requirements for Huntington Beach were in the mid-1300s, and they had already constructed some 900 units that kind of put them somewhat along the way. The city next door only requires 86 units for compliance for arena. So it was an interesting disparity. So I just want to bring that up for the record, that we've got a city that actually has some movement in trying to comply. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions from committee members? Seeing none, we're going to open up for public comment.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Niccolo DeLuca here on the behalf of the Oakland mayor. Strong support of this. Thank you very much, especially the homelessness funding. Really want to thank and echo what Senator Skinner said with regard to emergency rental assistance. Looking forward to that discussion. It's a very valuable tool for us, so thank you.
Thank you. Next witness.
Jennifer Speck on behalf of the California Association of Realtors here in support of the bill, specifically the provisions related to planning and finally enforcing the state's housing law. It's the first step we need in order to get the production that we need to plan first.
Thank you. Next witness.
Chris Lee on behalf of the California State Association of Counties, strongly supportive of the $650 million for homelessness prevention, especially the $175 million allocation directly to counties. Counties, as you know, are the providers of the state's safety net services, so we think they're very well positioned to figure out where the gaps are and to help alleviate them and really tackle the homelessness crisis. We also wanted to thank the committee for the $500 million in infill infrastructure grants, especially the provisions in the bill that help smaller, more rural areas, including unincorporated areas, access the funding. And finally, while we have some concerns about the precedent-setting nature of the housing element enforcement provisions, we are neutral on that aspect of the bill.
Thank you. Next witness.
Nicole Wortelman on behalf of the Orange County Board of Supervisors and San Bernardino County Board of Supervisors in support of the homelessness funding. Very appreciative of the administration's legislature's proposals as well as all of the staff work. In particular, Orange County is additionally appreciative of the local housing trust language allowing SB2 as a local match. And San Bernardino County would like to thank you for providing funding for both counties and COCs.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members. Martha Guerrero representing the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors. Thank you very much for the $650 million and also for the $175 million going to counties. As CSAC mentioned, we are very well aware of the gaps and also bridging those gaps with the county services and supports that is needed. Also appreciative on how it builds upon all the other efforts to address poverty, ending poverty. A lot of these are families, and so this is going to help bridge those efforts. Appreciate the comments mentioned here about preventing homelessness. As you know, we have a few bills that we are sponsoring, one SB 329 and a few other bills that we're supporting to prevent homelessness and preventing evictions and those that are out on the streets and we're having to deal with, and higher numbers that we're having to deal with as a result of that. So continue to work with you as we move forward on any language that is proposed to be changed, as we have a lot of experience with that in Los Angeles County, and also continuing to work with you and welcome you to come to visit our county to look at what we're doing to prevent homelessness and addressing homelessness on the streets. Thank you.
Thank you. Next witness.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jean Hurst here today on behalf of the urban counties of California. Similar to my colleagues, we're in strong support of the allocations with regards to homelessness, planning and infrastructure grants as well. We look forward to continuing to work with you on these important issues.
Thank you. Final witness.
Kim Lewis representing the California Coalition for Youth and speaking in support of the homeless funding, and appreciate the set aside for youth. Specifically, I would note in the definition for youth, especially, it includes those youth who are couch surfing, so we can really address the ones who are outside the HUD restrictive definition, and appreciate the systems planning works where we know where the gaps are for youth, because 80% at the last 2018 point in count were unsheltered. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Seeing no further witnesses, if the sergeants wouldn't mind calling B&P committee, I think that's where Senator Panius let them know that we're about to take the roll. The bill has been moved. Please call the roll.
AB 101, the motion is due. Pass. Mitchell.
Aye.
Mitchell, aye. Nielsen.
Aye.
Nielsen, aye. Bell. Caballero. Aye. Caballero, aye. Dolly.
Aye.
Dolly, aye. Hurtado.
Aye.
Hurtado, aye. Jones.
Aye.
Jones, aye. Leyba. McGuire. Manning. Manning,
aye.
Morlock.
Aye.
Morlock, aye. Pan. Roth.
Aye.
Roth, aye. Skinner.
Aye.
Skinner, aye. Stern.
Aye.
Stern, aye. Stone.
Aye.
Stone, aye. Umberg.
Aye.
Umberg, aye. Wieckowski.
Aye.
Wieckowski, aye.
call open for about 5 minutes to allow other members to come and add on. Thank you. Call the absent members, please.
Leyva, McGuire, Pan. Pan, aye. With a vote of 15-0, the measure passes and Budget Committee stands adjourned.